The Bull of Rome. Chapter 2. Luther's Letter to the Emperor. Luther had foreseen that the cause of the Reformation would soon be carried before the new emperor. He wrote to Charles, while this prince was yet at Madrid, "If the cause that I defend," said he, "is worthy of appearing before the throne of the majesty of heaven, it ought not to be unworthy of engaging the attention of a prince of this world. O Charles, first of the kings of the earth, I throw myself a suppliant at the feet of your most serene majesty. Deign to receive under the shadow of your wings, not by me, but the cause of that eternal truth, for the defense of which God has entrusted you with the sword." The young monarch laid aside this singular letter from a German monk, and made no reply to it. While Luther was vainly turning towards Madrid, the storm seemed to increase around him. Fanaticism was kindling in Germany. Hochstraten, indefatigable in his attempts at persecution, had extracted certain theses from Luther's writings. At his demand, the universities of Cologne and Louvain had condemned these works. That of Erfurt, still exasperated at Luther's preference for Wittenberg, was about to follow their example. But having been informed of it, the doctor wrote to Lang so spirited a letter that the Erfurt divines were dismayed and kept silent. The condemnation pronounced at Cologne and Louvain sufficed, however, to inflame men's minds. Nay, more, the priests of Meissen, who had espoused Emser's quarrel, said publicly, "Melanchthon is our authority, that he who should kill Luther would be without sin." "Now is the time," said Luther, "when men will think they do Christ a service by putting us to death." These homicidal words were destined to produce their fruit in due season. One day, says a biographer, as Luther was in front of the Augustine cloister, a stranger, who held a pistol concealed under his cloak, accosted him in these words, "Why do you go thus alone?" "I am in God's hands," replied Luther. "He is my strength and my shield. What can man do unto me?" Upon this the stranger turned pale, adds the historian, and fled away trembling. Serra Longa, the ambassador at the Augsburg conference, wrote to the elector about this time, "Let not Luther find an asylum in the states of your highness. Let him be rejected of all, and stoned in the face of heaven. That will be more pleasing to me than if I received 10,000 crowns from you." But it was particularly in the direction of Rome that the storm was gathering. Valentine Turban, a Thuringian nobleman, vicar to the Archbishop of Mentz, and a zealous partisan of the papacy, was the elector of Saxony's representative at the papal court. Turban, ashamed of the protection accorded by his master to an heretical monk, was impatient at seeing his mission paralyzed by this imprudent conduct. He imagined that, by alarming the elector, he would induce him to abandon the rebellious divine. "They will not listen to me here," wrote he to his master, "because of the protection you showed to Luther." But the Romans were deceived if they thought to frighten the prudent Frederick. This prince was aware that the will of God and the movements of nations were more irresistible than the decrees of the papal chancery. He ordered his envoy to intimate to the Pope that, far from defending Luther, he had always left him to defend himself. Besides, he had already called upon him to quit Saxony and the university, that the doctor had declared his willingness to obey, and that he would not then be in the electoral states, if the legate himself, Charles of Miltitz, had not entreated the prince to keep him near at hand, for fear that, by going to other countries, Luther would act with greater liberty than even in Saxony. Frederick went farther than this. He desired to enlighten Rome. "Germany," continues he in his letter, "now possesses a great number of learned men, well taught in every language and science. The laity themselves begin to have understanding, and to love the holy scriptures. If, therefore, the reasonable conditions of Dr. Luther are rejected, there is great cause to fear that peace will never be re-established." Luther's doctrine has struck deep root into many hearts. If, instead of refuting it by the testimony of the Bible, you strive to destroy him by the thunderbolts of the ecclesiastical authority, great scandals will arise, and ruinous and terrible revolts will be excited. The elector, having the greatest confidence in Luther, communicated Turban's letter to him, with another that he had received from Cardinal St. George. The reformer was agitated as he read them. He immediately perceived the dangers by which he was surrounded. His soul was for a time quite overwhelmed, but it was in such moments that the whole strength of his faith shone forth. Often weak, and ready to fall into dejection, he rose again, and appeared greater in the midst of the tempest. He longed to be delivered from such trials, but he saw at what price peace was offered to him, and he indignantly rejected it. "Hold my peace," exclaimed he. "I am disposed to do so, if they will permit me, that is, if they will make others keep silence. If any one desires my places, let him take them. If any one desires to destroy my writings, let him burn them. I am ready to keep quiet, provided they do not require that the truth of the gospel should be silent also. I do not ask for a cardinal's hat. I ask not for gold, or for anything that Rome values. There is nothing in the world they cannot obtain from me, provided they will not shut up the way of salvation against Christians. Their threats do not alarm me, their promises cannot seduce me." Animated with such sentiments, Luther soon recovered his militant disposition, and preferred the Christian warfare to the calm of solitude. One night was sufficient to bring back his desire of overthrowing Rome. "I have taken my part," wrote he on the morrow. "I despise the fury of Rome, and contemn her favors. No more reconciliation, no more communication with her forever. Let her condemn me, let her burn my writings. In my turn, I will condemn and publicly burn the pontifical law, that nest of every heresy. The moderation I have hitherto shown has been unavailing. I now renounce it." His friends were far from being thus tranquil. Great was the consternation at Wittenberg. "We are in a state of extraordinary expectation," said Melanchthon. "I would rather die than be separated from Luther. If God does not help us, we shall all perish." "Our dear Luther is still alive," wrote he a month later in his anxiety. "May it please God to grant him a long life, for the Roman sycophants are making every exertion to put him to death. Let us pray that this sole avenger of sacred theology may long survive." These prayers were heard. The warning the elector had given Rome through his envoy was not without foundation. Luther's words had found an echo everywhere in cottages and convents, in the homes of the citizens and in the castles of the nobles, in the universities and in the palaces of kings. "If my life," he had said to Duke John of Saxony, "has been instrumental to the conversion of a single man, I shall willingly consent to see all my books perish." It was not one man, it was a great multitude, that had found the light in the writings of the humble doctor. Everywhere, accordingly, were men to be found ready to protect him. The sword intended to slay him was forging in the Vatican, but heroes were springing up in Germany to shield him with their bodies. At the moment when the bishops were chafing with rage, when princes kept silence, when the people were in expectation, and when the first murmurs of the thunder were beginning to be heard from the seven hills, God aroused the German nobles to make a rampart for his servant. Sylvester of Schomberg, one of the most powerful knights of Franconia, sent his son to Wittenberg at this time with a letter for the reformer. "Your life is in danger," wrote he. "If the support of the electors, princes, or magistrates fail you, I entreat you to beware of going to Bohemia, where in former times learned men have had much to undergo. Rather come to me. God willing, I shall soon have collected more than 100 gentlemen, and with their help I shall be able to protect you from every danger." Francis of Sickingen, the hero of his age, of whose intrepid courage we have already been witnesses, loved the reformer, because he found him worthy of being loved, and also because he was hated by the monks. "My services, my goods, and my body, all that I possess," wrote he to Luther, "are at your disposal. You desire to maintain the Christian truth. I am ready to aid you in the work." Harmuth of Kronberg held the same language. Lastly, Ulrich of Hutten, the poet and valiant knight of the 16th century, never ceased speaking in Luther's favor. But what a contrast between these two men! Hutten wrote to the reformer, "It is with swords and with bows, with javelins and bombs, that we must crush the fury of the devil." Luther, on receiving these letters, exclaimed, "I will not have recourse to arms and bloodshed in defense of the gospel. By the word the earth has been subdued, by the word the church has been saved, and by the word also it shall be re-established. I do not despise his offer," said he at another time on receiving Schomberg's letter, which we have mentioned above, "but I will rely upon nothing but Jesus Christ." It was not thus the Roman pontiff spoke when they waded in the blood of the Waldenses and Albigenses. Hutten felt the difference between his cause and Luther's, and he accordingly wrote to him with noble-mindedness, "As for me, I am busied with the affairs of men, but you soar far higher, and are occupied solely with those of God." He then set out to win, if possible, Charles and Ferdinand to the side of truth. Luther at this time met with a still more illustrious protector. Erasmus, whom the Romanists so often quote against the Reformation, raised his voice and undertook the Reformer's defense, after his own fashion, however, that is to say, without any show of defending him. On the 1st of November 1519, this Patriarch of Learning wrote to Albert, Elector of Mentz and Primate of all Germany, a letter in which, after describing in vivid colors the corruption of the Church, he says, "This is what stirred up Luther, and made him oppose the intolerable imprudence of certain doctors. For what other motive can we ascribe to a man who seeks not honors and who cares not for money? Luther has dared doubt the virtue of indulgences, but others before him had most unblushingly affirmed it. He feared not to speak, certainly with little moderation, against the power of the Roman pontiff, but others before him had extolled it without reserve. He has dared contemn the decrees of St. Thomas, but the Dominicans had set them almost above the gospel. He has dared give utterance to his scruples about confession, but the monks continually made use of this ordinance as a net in which to catch and enslave the consciences of men." Pious souls were grieved at hearing that in the universities there was little mention of the evangelical doctrine, that in the assemblies of Christians very little was heard of Christ, that nothing was there talked of, except the power of the pontiff, and the opinions of the Romish doctors, and that the whole sermon was a mere matter of lucre, flattery, ambition, and imposture. It is to such a state of affairs that we should ascribe Luther's violent language, such as Erasmus's opinion on the state of the Church and on the Reformer. This letter, which was published by Ulrich Hutten, then residing at the court of Mentz, made a profound impression. At the same time, men more obscure than Erasmus and than all the knights, but were destined to be more powerful auxiliaries, rallied round Luther in every direction. Dr. Botsimus Abstemius, canon of Constance, wrote to him thus, "Now that you have become the friend of the universe, or at least of the better part of the world, that is to say, of good and true Christians, you must also become mine, whether you will or not. I am so delighted with your writings, that nothing gives me greater pleasure than to be living at a time when not only profane but also sacred literature is resuming its pristine splendor." And at nearly the same period Gaspard Hedio, preacher at Ball, wrote to the Reformer, "Most dear sir, I see that your doctrine is of God, and that it cannot be destroyed, that it becomes daily more efficacious, and that every hour it is winning souls to Christ by turning them away from sin and attracting them to real piety. Do not halt there, therefore, O Liberator, but exert all your power to restore the yoke of Christ, so light and easy to bear. Be yourself the general, and we will follow after you, like soldiers whom nothing can tear from you." Thus at one time Luther's enemies oppress him, at another his friends spring up to defend him. "My bark," said he, "floats to and fro, the sport of the winds. Hope and fear prevail by turns. But what matters it?" And yet these testimonies of sympathy were not without influence upon his mind. "The Lord reigns," said he. "I see him there, as if I could touch him." Luther felt that he was not alone. His words had borne fruit, and this thought filled him with fresh courage. The fear of compromising the elector no longer checked him, when he found other defenders ready to brave the anger of Rome. He became more free, and if possible more determined. This is an important epoch in the development of Luther's character. "Rome ought to understand," wrote he at this period to the elector's chaplain, "that, even should she succeed by her threats in expelling me from Wittenberg, she would only injure her cause. It is not in Bohemia, but in the very heart of Germany that those are to be found who are ready to defend me against the thunders of the papacy. If I have not done my enemies all the harm I am preparing for them, they must ascribe it neither to my moderation nor to their tyranny, but to the elector's name and to the interests of the University of Wittenberg, which I feared to compromise. Now that I have such fears no longer, they will see me fall with fresh vigor upon Rome and upon her courtiers." And yet it was not on the great that Luther fixed his hopes. He had been often solicited to dedicate a book to Duke John, the elector's brother. He had not done so. "I am afraid," said he, "that the suggestion comes from himself. Holy Scripture should subserve the glory of God's name alone." Luther now recovered from his fears, and dedicated his sermon on good works to Duke John. This is one of the writings in which the Reformer lays down with the greatest force the doctrine of justification by faith, that powerful truth, whose strength he sets far above the sword of Hutten, the army of Sickingen, and the protection of dukes and electors. "The first, the noblest, the sublimest of all works," says he, "is faith in Jesus Christ. It is from this work that all other works must proceed. They are but the vassals of faith, and receive their efficacy from it alone. If a man feels in his heart the assurance that what he has done is acceptable to God, the work is good, if it were merely the lifting up of a straw. But if he have not this assurance, his work is not good, even should he raise the dead. A heathen, a Jew, a Turk, a sinner, can perform all the other works. But to trust firmly in God, and to feel an assurance that we are accepted by him, is what a Christian, strong in grace, alone is capable of doing. A Christian who possesses faith in God does everything with liberty and joy, while the man who is not at one with God is full of care and kept in bondage. He asks himself with anguish how many works he should perform. He runs to and fro. He questions this man and that. He nowhere finds peace, and does everything with sorrow and fear. Consequently, I have always extolled faith, but in the world it is otherwise. There, the essential thing is to have many works high and great, and of every dimension, without caring whether they are quickened by faith. Thus, men build their peace not on God's good pleasure, but on their own merits, that is to say, on sand. To preach faith, it has been said, is to prevent good works. But if a man should possess the strength of all men united, or even of all creatures, this sole obligation of living in faith would be a task too great for him ever to accomplish. If I say to a sick man, "Be well, and thou shalt have the use of thy limbs," will any one say that I forbid him to use his limbs? Must not health precede labor? It is the same when we preach faith. It should go before works in order that the works themselves should exist. Where then, you will say, can we find this faith, and how can we receive it? This is in truth what it is most important to know. Faith comes solely from Jesus, who was promised and given freely. O man, figure Jesus Christ to yourself, and contemplate how God in him has shown thee his mercy, without any merit on thy part going before. Draw from this image of his grace the faith and assurance that all thy sins are forgiven thee. Works cannot produce it. It flows from the blood and wounds and death of Christ, thence it wells forth into our hearts. Christ is the rock whence flow milk and honey. Deuteronomy 32. As we cannot notice all Luther's writings, we have quoted a few short passages from this discourse on good works, in consequence of the opinion the Reformer himself entertained of it. "In my own judgment," said he, "it is the best I ever published." And he added immediately this deep reflection, "But I know that when I please myself with what I write, the infection of that bad leaven hinders it from pleasing others." Melanchthon, in forwarding this discourse to a friend, accompanied it with these words, "There is no one among all the Greek and Latin writers who has ever come nearer than Luther to the spirit of St. Paul."